circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their full attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Because of weather delays at O'Hare this morning, we are going to take the cases scheduled for today out of order. We will hear the argument first in United States against Orocho. Our apologies, Mr. Llewellyn. We will get to your case shortly, I think. Mr. Frankel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Scott Frankel. The attorneys for the appellants have divided up the arguments, and I will address the first argument in the brief, whether the trial court abused its discretion in failing to grant a new trial based on the post-trial testimony of one of the jurors who served in the case. The government and the appellants agree that a two-part test applies to the issue of juror dishonesty. First, whether the juror failed to honestly answer a question on voir dire, and second, whether the correct response would have provided a valid basis for a challenge for cause. The juror at issue, Juror Mickens, failed to honestly answer a question posed to him during voir dire. While he volunteered during voir dire that he knew one of the government's important witnesses, witness Allen, he was not truthful until after the trial was over concerning the true scope and extent of his relationship with this witness. As set forth in the brief, Mickens knew Allen more than just a casual acquaintance. During the questioning of during voir dire, Mr. Mickens gave the impression, which we contend was a false impression, that he only knew witness Allen in passing. The fact of the matter is there was a much greater relationship than just a casual acquaintance.
Is there any obligation on defense counsel to explore that?
I think that the defense counsel was given, the judge did explore and ask thorough questions of the witness, I'm sorry, of the juror, based on what the defense counsel had heard. I believe that it might not occur to them to ask subsequent questions based on what they had heard. I don't think that they would suspect that.
Do you think there's any time when a juror says he knows one of the witnesses that you wouldn't want to explore more fully?
Looking at the facts of this case, in hindsight, I would think that the defense lawyers might have wanted to ask follow-up
hindsight
questions.
Hindsight would be certainly one thing, but I'm just speaking as a matter of course. Wouldn't you think so?
I would think that some questions should have been asked. On the other hand, I don't think that the outcome in this case should be different because the defense didn't ask follow-up questions at the time, because it was Juror Mickens who had an obligation under the circumstances to answer the judge's questions completely and truthfully. What he did tell the judge was that he only knew the witness, and it might not have even been the witness, according to the testimony, but he suspected he might have only known the witness as a casual acquaintance in passing. And it was learned later that actually he knew him in a much more detailed way, that Juror Mickens' parents owned the building where the witness lived, that the witness and his girlfriend had been not paying rent in that building, that an eviction proceeding, a lawsuit, had actually been instituted against the girlfriend to evict her.
She was the lessee, right?
That's correct. Her name was on the list.
Whatever his connection is not as part of the contract.
That's true, but I think that during the testimony after the trial, it became clear that Mickens knew that Allen was her boyfriend and that they had a relationship and that he was providing for her as well as paying the rent. So that even though she was the specific target of the lawsuit, the relationship between her and Allen, the witness, was well known to Mickens. And I think that Allen would have and Mickens clearly would have spoken about this during the numerous times that they had conversations. And it did come out that they had numerous conversations up to five conversations, and that they met at a party and had a conversation where they spoke about Alan's relationship with his girlfriend. None of this was known to the court at the time of the initial questioning of the witness. The correct responses, if the juror had answered correctly, I think it's clear that the court would have entertained a motion to...
What was the incorrect answer, in your view?
The correct answer would have been, I know Mr. Allen, I know him because his girlfriend leases an apartment from my parents.
No, I'm not asking for what would a favorable narration have been. What was the question, and what was the false answer?
I believe the question was, do you know, are you familiar with any of the potential witnesses that were named in the case? And I think that...
Yeah, and he answered that question, yes. So
yes.
What was the false answer, in your view?
That he didn't give a complete and thorough answer to the question, which would have been, I know him more than just a casual acquaintance. I think that really goes to the heart of what the court needs to know as far as whether a juror is going to be biased based on their relationship with a witness. I see that my time is up. Unless there are additional questions, I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Thank you.
Mr. Kessler.
May it please the court, I am Luke Kasson. I represented Mr. Orocho at the trial level and on appeal on appointment. The first issue that I would like to address with the court is the insufficiency of the evidence on count 8. That is a alleged violation of section 1512B of the United States Code, of the criminal code. Witness tampering requires proof that there was some kind of a corrupt persuasion of the witness. In this particular case, the facts, as outlined at the trial, belied the corrupt persuasion part of that test. On the 2nd of July, 1996, 1998, the witness who has been identified as Dennis Allen was arrested in Gary. Between the 2nd of July and the 6th of July, he was detained at the Gary Police Department, not in contact with either Mr. Colon or Mr. Orocho. Subsequent to that, he was transferred to the Metropolitan Correctional Center here in Chicago, and then was submitted for a detention hearing before Magistrate Radovich. While in custody at the Gary Police Department, he was questioned by GRIT, the Gary Response, the Drug Task Force, the Federal Drug Task Force. During that interrogation, he gave certain false answers in the statement to the GRIT team. Again, when he was submitted for the detention hearing, he again gave false answers regarding his involvement in particular, but also with regard to his competency and why he felt he was incompetent. He said he was drinking and he was drunk and he was high. Subsequent to the detention hearing, he was transported back to the Metropolitan Correctional Center, where he alleges between approximately September, October, he was moved from floor 13 to floor 19. It was after that movement to the 19th floor that he alleges he was approached by Mr. Colon and asked to sign an affidavit. The affidavit, as he has referred to it, is really a judicial complaint form that many inmates at the MCC were preparing to file it to the Judicial Board in Washington, D.C. And it gave a brief synopsis of each individual inmate's facts. He did sign that form. In that statement, it was consistent with both his detention hearing testimony and his statement to the GRIT team. Now, at trial, he testified that Mr. Colon and Mr. Orocho approached him with the intention of changing his testimony. That is simply not borne out by the facts as we have as we established them at trial. What we have here is simply a recitation of the facts that he had already presented to the court in one instance and to the grid team in the other. There certainly is no evidence that there was any corrupt persuasion. The evidence was clearly that the, if we were to believe it, that they went down, they talked to him, they asked him to sign the statement. He agreed to sign the statement with the simple statement that I was tired of hearing of it. Moving on to the confrontation issue, the government asked or objected to the disclosure of the exact penalty provided that Allen and Hernandez were exposed to. It is our position that the trial court erred in not permitting trial counsel to explore the exact penalty that the that both Hernandez and Allen were exposed to and thereby were biased from it. What the trial court essentially did was thwart us as defense counsel from exposing the complete bias of the two defendants or two witnesses. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kessel. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent Mark Flores in this matter. Mr. Flores was plainly among the least culpable in this matter. The district court committed clear error by denying him a reduction for his minimal or minor role in the offense. The reduction for the minor or minimal role is designed for cases just like this one, where a defendant is held responsible mainly for the relevant conduct of his co-defendants. Mr. Flores was sentenced to 322 months in prison based on primarily the actions of Mr. Orocho and Mr. Cohen.
What about the time that he was, what was it, 2 weeks or something?
2 weeks.
Exposure to this whole thing. What went on during that 2 weeks?
The record shows that it was business as usual, but I think we need to keep in mind that that business had been going on for nearly 7 months, which is a large time period. Mr. Flores simply was there for 2 weeks. He was homeless, he was a crack user, and he slept there because he had no other place to sleep. I think that in comparison to the rest of the participants in this case, he played a very minimal role in the offense. He answered the door a couple times by his own admission, and he let one person put money on the table. But he was held accountable for a massive amount of crack cocaine, the guns that his co-defendants carried, and the conspiracy that existed for the month ahead of his time in the house.
So there's no question as far as his conviction that he was held accountable for the whole conspiracy.
Right. There's no question. This is unlike a good percentage of the cases before this court, where a defendant is held responsible solely for his own conduct. That may be a part of a larger conspiracy, but he's only charged and convicted of his own conduct. Mr. Flores was convicted and convicted of conspiracy, several counts, and the gun charge, and all of those convictions were based on acts other than his own in the house. So as to not take up some of the rebuttal time for my co-counsel, Mr. Flores respectfully requests this court to reverse and remand his sentence, his case for resentencing for the application of a minimal role, or at the least a minor role adjustment. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Mr. Benson.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Philip Benson. I represent the United States of America. I will address the arguments in the same order. Opposing counsel. Regarding Mr. Mickens, and his knowledge of Mr. Allen. I believe the record is clear that at the time Mr. Mickens was brought into the actual jury box at 12, almost 4 hours had passed since the initial voir dire had begun, and he was being questioned as a second alternate. That in no way, shape, or form changes any of Mr. Mickens' obligations, obviously, to be as forthright as he can be. But on the same note, initially asked at the beginning of voir dire, when the judge read the list of witnesses, 4 hours before Mr. Mickens was called into the jury box in probably at least one recess, the judge had read off the list of the witnesses and asked everybody, please keep that list in mind, and if you get into the jury box, please tell us. Well, 4 hours later, the juror, Mr. Mickens, who the defense counsel wants you to believe intentionally lied, brought that to the court's attention on his own volition. The court didn't reread the list. The court simply asked when Mr. Mickens, as the second alternate, I believe one other alternate was also potential alternate, was also being questioned, said, Judge, there's a question I would have answered yes to. And Judge Moody asked, what was that? He said, I think I might know one of the witnesses, the one named Allen. And that's the questioning that ensues, that's in the record, that's in the briefs of the court, that the court has seen. Clearly, we operate in the courtroom on a daily basis, and we have a different way that we view the courtroom as lawyers and certainly as judges. But we have to put ourselves in the shoes of an average person. In this case, I believe he was an accountant who comes into a federal court. I don't believe he had ever sat as a juror before, and there was no indication he had been a witness, so perhaps for the first time, he's being asked questions by the federal judge seated on the bench. And he brings it to the judge's attention and then answers what I frankly believe to be to the best of his ability. You know, these were open-ended questions that he was asked. How do you know Mr. Allen? And he said in passing, and I think as Judge Moody's order quite aptly portrays, that phrase in passing can mean a lot of different things to different people. Certainly, I think if I had seen somebody like Mr. Mickens for a total of 40 minutes over the span of however long he had been at that residence, I think that phrase can, from an honest perspective of a witness, mean in passing. Wasn't someone that he regularly dealt with. There were no questions asked of Mr. Mickens once they found out that he had any knowledge of Mr. Allen, such as, well, what do you mean by in passing? What does that mean? Do you know anyone else? Do you know any friends or relatives of his? Obviously, it all came out at the subsequent hearing for a new trial. But I believe, given the standard of review that this court has to operate under, that clearly I don't believe that it's fair to say that this citizen came in here and lied. And taking the argument one step further, that even assuming arguendo that he did, and I will not ever say that I believe this juror lied, there's no indication that biased this jury. There are just as many reasons as he could have discounted Mr. Allen's testimony as he could have given it more credit. Because of his relation, it wasn't a very good, whatever little knowledge he had of Mr. Allen or Mr. Allen's wife, girlfriend, I don't even think Mr. Mickens knew for sure. It wasn't a very favorable impression. He had to sue his girlfriend or wife, however the record shows, I'm not sure exactly what it says. So we believe that they haven't met the two-pronged test that is established, that the juror failed to honestly answer a material question. We believe Mr. Mickens did. Had he been asked more questions, he would have given more honest answers. And even if the correct information would have been provided, or it wouldn't have provided a valid basis for a challenge for cause. Regarding count 8 and the obstruction, the defendants admit that there needs to be corrupt persuasion. And the government doesn't disagree that Mr. Allen lied to Grit when he was arrested. And he also lied at the detention or suppression hearing testimony about that he was so drunk when he gave the statement he didn't know what he was doing. But certainly, if you look at Mr. Allen's statement and his testimony in hindsight, that was a lie. and the defendants knew it was a lie. They knew that Mr. Allen was involved in the crack operation. And in his statement, in his lies at the detention hearing, he said that I wasn't involved. Colon and Orocho knew that at the time they approached him to sign an affidavit or at least to get him to recant. Therefore, that was corrupt persuasion. The mere fact that they didn't come up with the lie and only encouraged Mr. Allen to continue it once he had agreed to cooperate, the government believes does constitute corrupt persuasion. Regarding the argument that the court improperly denied the defense's request to go into the exact penalties before the jury, it's important to realize that the exact charge that Mr. Allen faced and Ms. Carmen Hernandez, that count was identical to the count the defendant was facing. To get into the exact penalties would have been to tell this jury something that we never want juries to know, and that is what the exact penalty it is that, or the maximum penalty that a defendant faces for the very fear that they may consider that when rendering their verdict. In this case, the defendants were provided opportunities to go into the fact that Mr. Allen and Ms. Hernandez received a substantial benefit, that they were testifying pursuant to a plea agreement. But what other information did the jury also have before them to help assess any bias or any credibility that Mr. Allen may have had? Well, they knew that he had two prior felony convictions, one for robbery and also another one for burglary, and the government even brought out that he had been arrested on a misdemeanor theft charge that was later dismissed. They had that evidence before them to determine whether or not he was a credible person. They also had before them information that Mr. Allen was a regular crack user and had used crack for a very long period of time. They had information before them from Ms. Hernandez about the exact same thing, that she had been a longtime user of crack and had problems with that. The government believes that they had the evidence that was allowed in regarding the cross-examination of Mr. Allen was more than sufficient for this jury to make a proper and correct determination as to whether Mr. Allen should be believed. Lastly, regarding the trial court's failure to deny Mr. Flores the reduction for either a minimal or minor participant. Under Application Note 4 of Guideline Section 3B1.2, a minimal participant must be plainly least culpable and lack a knowledge or understanding of the scope of the enterprise or the activities of other. It's intended to be used infrequently. In synopsis, that's what that application note says. Well, an examination, I believe it was Agent Steele who testified as to the confession that was put in of Mr. Flores, and it was redacted pursuant to the teachings of Bruton. And basically, at that time, you know, Mr. Flores said that he knew who ran the drug operation, that he took, this is his own words, that he took money on at least one occasion and then another, that he knew who the cooker of the crack cocaine was, that he had seen the powder cocaine cooked into crack, and that he saw Allen, Dennis Allen, selling the drugs at 1105, and that the house had a minimum of 18 to 25 people coming there every day, and the house averaged approximately $1,000 a day in drug sales. Clearly, it shows knowledge of the scope and extent of the conspiracy. And although Mr. Flores in that confession minimized his own involvement, he clearly expressed an understanding of what the conspiracy was all about and who was doing what. But then look at the testimony. I'm sorry.
Is it accurate that his duration was 2 weeks? Exposure or whatever.
I think somewhere probably between 2 weeks to a month. I'm not exactly sure. Mr. Allen seemed to think it was a little bit longer. I'm not exactly sure as I stand here, John, but I think it was between 2 weeks to a month. Mr. Allen went on to provide testimony when asked what Mr. Flores' role was Mr. Allen's testimony was that on volume 3, page 147 of the transcript, Flores was doing the same as everyone else, selling dope. He acted as a lookout for about a month. So that would seem to indicate that it was more than the 2 weeks initially. He answered the door to get money, and then he delivered the dope. And then he was asked questions about whether or not he, Flores, ever had a firearm. Mr. Allen was asked questions about whether or not Mr. Orocho ever had a firearm and Mr. Colon. Mr. Allen identified each of those firearms that each of those individuals had. When asked, did Mr. Flores ever have a gun, he said no, but he was basically always playing with Orocho's and Colon's gun, taking the bullets out. And I stand here, and I'm not 100% sure the record reflects this, but I thought there was also something in Mr. Flores' confession that he had known some of these individuals prior to this. Clearly, it doesn't fit a minimal participant. Was he a minor participant? The government believes no. He was as culpable as Dennis Allen and Ms. Hernandez. He actually knew a little bit more. He acted as a lookout. Mr. Allen never did that. He was not the strong arm at any time for this drug operation that was going on at 1105 Clay Street. There's no indication that Mr. Allen ever had a firearm when he was selling any dope at 1105 Clay Street. So clearly, we believe at the very least, his actions, Mr. Flores' actions, were consistent with that of at least Mr. Allen and Ms. Hernandez, who were the other people working in this drug enterprise. Was his role less than Mr. Colon and Mr. Orocho's? Certainly. But they received an enhancement for being the manager, and then I think Mr. Colon received an enhancement for being the organizer or leader. But was Mr. Flores' role less than the average participant, that of Mr. Allen or Ms. Hernandez? The government believes not. And there's no questions. I'll rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. The defense collectively has a couple of minutes, maybe as much as 150 seconds. How fast can you talk?
Well, pretty fast, but I will not. May it please the court. I just want to address a few of the statements of the government's counsel, particularly with regard to Dennis Allen's testimony. He testified that he had been part of the drug operation for 2 months, and that perhaps Mr. Flores had been there for a month. It wasn't clear. However, in his statement to the police, he did not identify Mr. Flores. He never mentioned Mr. Flores. He said that a man named Hector was the lookout, and that Mr. Allen, was the one who answered the door and delivered the crack. And if he couldn't deliver the crack at that time, that he would call either Mr. Orocho or Mr. Colon. Never mentioned Mr. Flores. And to balance that out, Ms. Carmen Hernandez testified that she never saw Mr. Flores either smoke crack or sell it. And Mr. Flores' statement is consistent with a minor participant who was only there for 2 weeks. Of course he had seen crack made and sold. He was there for 2 weeks. They had a pretty busy drug operation. So that's consistent with just being there for 2 weeks. That's no indication that he knew what had been going on for the last 7 months. And if we're going to talk about average participants, there are quite a few participants in this, and each one of them had a more major role than Mr. Flores. Obviously, Colon and Orocho had major roles in the conspiracy. Dennis Allen put himself there much longer than Mr. Flores. He also put himself there every day, delivering the crack and taking cash for it. He was the one who answered the door when officers came to inspect a disturbance reported by William Price. And Carmen Hernandez was the girlfriend of Orocho and possibly even Colon, and had also been there longer than Mr. Flores. So in comparison to the remaining participants, Mr. Flores was a minimal participant in this matter. And I believe my time is up, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
And Mr. Frankel and Mr. Kasson, we particularly thank you for accepting the appointment in this case.
Thank you.